Back Talk is an extension of the award-winning movie review show It's Movie Time, which airs on Fridays at 4:01 and 8:01 p.m. on WCBE 90.5 FM. Produced and hosted by John DeSando, the podcast features additional content and banter with guests. Back Talk is listed by FeedSpot as one of the top 10 movie podcasts on NPR.
Oh, how sweet that is. I'm John DeSando.
And I'm KG Klein.
And this is Back Talk. George Lucas and his whole empire have influenced science fiction and motion picture making.
His empire. I like how you put that.
Thank you. There's a new one out there. Star Wars, Mandalorian, and Grogu.
Yeah, today, folks, we're talking about one of the big summer blockbusters, or at least that's what Disney hopes. And it has been a while since we've had a Star Wars movie. The last one was Solo, A Star Wars Story, which did okay. I liked it, but it didn't do well enough for Disney to feel excited about making another one, because these are very expensive movies.
You warned me that this was actually so based on the TV series that you'll miss some of the joy of it if you don't. And I'm not a TV guy at all. So I'm sitting and not appreciating it the way you do.
Well, and that's an interesting point, John, because that raises the question, where is Disney taking Star Wars right now? We haven't had a Star Wars movie in a long time. Disney took Star Wars onto the small screen, and we've had a series of very successful Star Wars TV shows, especially Mandalorian and Andor, which have taken the Star Wars franchise and kept it going. And there hasn't been a lot of reason for Disney to spend $250 million on another movie. But with the success of Mandalorian, they decided, let's take one into the theater. And this really is a very big double episode of a Mandalorian show.
Well, that's what I'm thinking that must be, and why I'm not enjoying it as much as you do. Critics are actually applauding it.
Did I love it? No, it's not Rogue One, but it's not as mediocre as Solo, the Star Wars story, was. So think of it somewhere in terms of halfway between Solo and Rogue One.
You're not going to get all of Pedro Pascal, because in 90% of the movie he's got a helmet on, which means he has two body doubles to work on it.
It's all CGI in most cases.
And he must have made millions and shown up about twice.
Yeah, you see, he does take his helmet off. That's selling the film is the moment he takes his helmet off.
But he's got a helmet on for most of it.
Yes, he does.
So do not look for him, Pedro Pascal, to be your Han Solo.
Now, you don't look for Mandalorians to see a good-looking face, because, of course, that's part of the creed, is they never take their helmets off. The movie is uneven for me, John. I don't know if you felt the same way. I loved the first half hour. The first half hour was almost Rogue One quality. There's a great battle with some walkers where he's trying to take down this crime lord. So, we should back up a step. The movie is set about 2 or 3, 4 years after Return of the Jedi. So the Empire has fallen. There are still Imperial generals, Imperial senators spread throughout the galaxy, who have turned into regional crime lords, and they're running their little criminal empires. And the rebel forces, now the New Republic, are dispatching bounty hunters like our own Mandalorian here to go and hunt these crime lords, these former Imperial officers, down.
If you're missing the historical allusion to Nazis, then you're not paying attention to us.
Oh, yeah.
Your description is perfect about Nazi hunters. And that's the part that I liked, but it was never fully explored, I thought, for her. I just didn't get Jabba the Hutt's son.
And that doesn't work for me. I mean, at this point, that's just name drop. It annoys me when a movie, a tie-in, has to drop a lot of names from the original series. Can't it stand on its own? Couldn't it just be a young Hutt that's out there, has been captured, that they've got to go and rescue? Did it really have to be Jabba the Hutt's son? But that character didn't work too much for me, because there's a lot of generational trauma that gets dragged in. This is really a Star Wars movie for the younger crowd. If you have no fear of taking a 9, 10, 11-year-old to this movie, absolutely they're going to love it. There's nothing offensive about it. There's nothing racy about it. I do like how it starts out with the rebel base, and it has a very World War II feel. It almost could be the opening scene of They Were Expendable, or the Fighting Seabees. They're on this, what looks like a Pacific island, and they've got this isolated little base, and from there they're trying to run a regional, New Republic operation to bring down some of these crime lords, with Sigourney Weaver, who has to be in every science fiction show, making an appearance, a very limited appearance, thankfully.
Yeah. She's Colonel Ward or something. Yeah. So she's a new character. I don't mind her. She's good.
She's good. She holds the scene together. Yeah. And then it gets into that really cool battle where he goes out and finds this crime lord, and then there's the Walker battle. I loved all that. It could have stayed like that for the next rest of the 2 hours.
And then they have stupid ones, like the one where he has to fight a sea dragon, is it?
Well, and then the movie, yes, he fights a snake dragon. But after the Walker battle, the movie turns all Sam Spade on us. It goes Dashiell Hammett, turns the Mandalorian into a gumshoe, and he's going around in a futuristic Chicago, passing out money, trying to get information on how to find these people. And that kind of worked for me, too. I thought, well, that's clever. Star Wars and Sam Spade, I can work with that. But then it gets very episodic with the battles.
Ken, first of all, visually, I thought it was weak.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah, I'm always critical of when it's darker on the screen.
Oh,
and this is dark.
And there's a lot of dark in this.
A lot of dark, yeah. And I like visually sharp images, particularly in Star Wars. I thought that was a strength of it. This one isn't. It's more like a video game to me. There's no grandeur about much of what's happening here.
And
as you're describing it, the gumshoe motif, and you're absolutely right, and that's pretty small peanuts considering Star Wars' grand universe.
And this is the point. Where is Disney taking the Star Wars franchise?
Yes.
Are we going to see more big movies? Are we ever going to see a movie on the scale of episode 7, 8, 9 again? Or is everything now going to be small scale films, little stories like this one? And I'm thinking that this is what Disney intends to do, is to shrink this and basically bring us some big TV episodes every couple of years and just use that for the movies and then keep the TV franchises going.
I wanted much more of Mandalorian. Much more, and without the helmet.
Really, what did you think of Grogu?
I'm not impressed, man. I'm not impressed by cute. I got Yoda.
Yeah, if you're not eating up the cute of baby Yoda, you're not going to get it.
My friend with me, Wayne Miller, whom you know, loves all this. And you get the little characters coming out, he just goes crazy.
Oh, no.
Nothing. Yeah. They're just squeaking. They're like mice.
See, I want to see some growth in Grogu, and we're really not seeing it. Throughout the TV series, he had little moments where he could do something he couldn't do before, but I want to see what direction they're taking. I want to see a big, flashy moment where Grogu suddenly is able to do something spectacular that nobody saw coming, and we haven't seen that. And I was hoping that would be in the movie, and it's not. Grogu really plays a very secondary role in this.
I'm always disappointed when they're just picking up on the Yoda motif and going with it with this character, but they're giving him nothing.
No.
They're giving him no life, as far as I can tell.
The only place where I give them kudos is I give them credit for doing a lot of Easter eggs. We see a lot of Star Wars characters, secondary or in the background characters, make an appearance in this. The Animan, the famous little Animan figure that you could never get, becomes a bunch of characters in this. The chess figures from the Millennium Falcon's chess game all are represented as real monsters in this. So somebody did their research. They said, wouldn't it be fun if we took this thing from Star Wars and brought it to life? Wouldn't it be fun if we took this action figure and threw it in there? A lot of little Easter eggs to reward the diehard Star Wars fans. I like that. I just wish that it wasn't so formula, because as I was walking out of the theater, I thought, this is the same movie as Iron Man 1.
Yeah.
This is the same movie as Captain Marvel.
And that would also be attributed to Jon Favreau, the director who did Iron Man.
It's very formula.
Yeah.
It's like you have to have a battle here. You have to have a big daddy battle here. You have to wrap up this way. That makes them all very predictable, because if you've seen it once, you've seen them all, and all you're doing is changing the universe and the characters.
K.G. Klein, the movie is Star Wars, Mandalorian, and Grogu. What do you recommend?
Well, you're not going to get another Star Wars movie for a while, so I'd say go see it. It will not disappoint you. It just may not be as big of a movie as you hope.
And if the kids haven't seen the TV series, I wonder if
you're still going to be fine, because they're going to get wrapped up in the little Grogu and all the characters and all the battles and all the action, and they're going to be just fine.
Well, I can't wait to get to science fiction, but we are talking about Star Wars, Mandalorian, and Grogu, and I think I can summarize your points and my points. This is not going to be for me, for sure, my recollection of the first time I saw Star Wars. It does not have its grandeur.
Oh, gosh. Grandeur. No. And I always struggle when we talk about movies that are good but not great.
Yes.
Because you want to talk them up. You want to talk about the good points. But at the end of the day, you're not going to come out of the theater with that impression that, wow, this was something that's just incredible. It's not that kind of movie.
We're covering this movie because it is so much a part of our culture and our lore. If we had taken the buzz earlier, we might not have done it, because we would have known exactly what you're saying. It's a good movie, but not a great movie. We primarily try, our cheerleaders really, who try to promote the best parts of whatever movies we have.
Oh, so sure. And we would be remiss in not talking about one of the big blockbuster movies.
Yes, we really have to.
When they're expecting a movie to make $300, $400 million or a lot more, it's probably a good idea for us to talk about it, because a lot of people are going to go to see the film. There are things we can point out. There's things we can say about the movie that maybe you might have missed if we hadn't said it.
Yeah. So let's go to some of the classics. And here's where I find that your estimate of it being good but not great holds tight. Because if we look at any of our favorite science fiction movies, this is not even close. For instance, the most impressive science fiction movie for me is 2001.
And for me as well.
Right.
2001 ranks as one of my top three movies.
Yeah.
It is the defining movie of science fiction. And it's not just me saying that. If you talk to directors, you talk to Steven Spielberg, you talk to George Lucas, you talk to Martin Scorsese, they went into the theater in 1968 as teenagers, and their jaws just dropped. And they said, I can never make a movie like that. Many of them have spent their careers trying to make a movie as good as 2001 A Space Odyssey, and we got a lot of really good movies that way.
Let's go way, way back.
Okay.
Even more impressive, well, much more impressive than this, is Metropolis.
Metropolis. Now we're going way back to the 1927.
I mean, when you look at it, yes, and you put the two side by side, there's no comparison.
Well, all dystopian future movies stand on the shoulder of Metropolis. Metropolis was way ahead of its time. Fritz Lang's portrayal of a German society pre-World War II, the workers were under the authority of the people, the smart, the educated, the bourgeoisie. But it was a bourgeoisie that was taking advantage of them and had to learn to respect the quality and the value of the people. It's a very communist movie when you really get down to it.
There are elements that I'm hoping we can redo in future times for ourselves, for our own culture.
Let's hope nobody tries to remake Metropolis. I don't think it could be remade contemporary.
But I meant in our own.
Oh, yes.
We may have a Metropolis.
A Metropolis, a time when the people in charge realize that the rest of the people come first. Yes.
Exactly. Wouldn't that be nice? Told that, but I haven't seen it. One of my favorites, which is completely different, is Forbidden Planet.
If we didn't have Forbidden Planet, we wouldn't have had Star Trek. And that's a given, because Gene Roddenberry saw Forbidden Planet and said, I could do that as a TV series. I could make a series about a spaceship crew going from planet to planet and having adventures. So Forbidden Planet is a very, very important film in the impact it had on science fiction. Also a tremendous movie. But yes, that film was so influential in that it created Star Trek.
How about Guardians of the Galaxy?
Guardians of the Galaxy is rock and roll science fiction. The first one was very different, very fun. I really have always enjoyed all the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. Yeah, I mean, it's a very tongue-in-cheek part of the Marvel franchise. They don't try to play it for anything but laughs, and it's well cast. So yeah, when it's a Guardians of the Galaxy film, standalone film, I usually really enjoy
it. Well, I was hoping for touches of Guardians of the Galaxy on this Star Wars Mandalorian.
But no, it wasn't. No, they're not going to go that tongue-in-cheek.
I know, and I thought maybe, since there was very little else to hold me, that maybe that was the way they would go.
They tried a little of that with Solo, A Star Wars Story, going a little tongue-in-cheek, and it didn't pay off for them, and Disney got... They didn't lose money on Solo, but they're acting like they did. As a result, Disney got cold feet on Star Wars as a film franchise until now, and they also got turned off to the idea of too much humor and too much lightheartedness in a Star Wars movie.
Another one that you and I have talked about several times, The Quiet Place.
Okay. Now, that's more horror than science
fiction.
Then
it is, and that's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still has sci-fi in it.
It has its one trick, which is that people can't talk. The monsters are not
so stupid. I don't know why they bother.
They're basically the same as the Demigorgons in Stranger Things.
Why do they try to do that? Just don't show me it. Just let me think about it.
It works better when they don't show it to you. Yeah, it really does. But it would have been a lot creepier.
For modern, sophisticated science fiction horror, it works for me.
Okay.
Because I also have a thing about dependence on smartphones. The fact that you have a movie where you can't use a smartphone, you're going to die.
Well, all of civilization has collapsed. There's no communication to begin with.
Yes, yes.
I want to talk about how that budget, to me, does not necessarily make a good science fiction film. And some of my favorite science fiction films have been very low-budget films.
Okay.
So the a concept of if you throw $250 million into the production, you're going to have a great science fiction film does not hold true. I'm going to throw out there, do you remember Silent Running with Bruce Dern?
Oh, boy, yes.
Low-budget, one of the great science fiction films of the new Hollywood era when directors were given a chunk of money and said, do what you want, do what inspires you, show us something that we hadn't thought of. Along comes Douglas Trumbull, the special effects man from 2001 that we just talked about, who they gave him some money and said, make a low-budget movie. He rents out a retired aircraft carrier in San Diego and films this amazing science fiction film about the green movement, about protecting the environment. Pretty much a one-man show, too, apart from the three little robots. And so great, great movie that gets overlooked now. But if you want to look at the really good science fiction films, you can't ignore Silent Running. And there's a few others. THX-1138, another one, very dystopian future. That plays well today because we're seeing that dystopian future and we're experiencing it more and more. So
I have to admit that I have much more positive vibes about Steven Spielberg's movies. And he's got one coming.
Disclosure Day is coming out. Yes, we're all looking forward
really
to that.
Which reminds me of how powerful Close Encounters of a Third Kind was for
Close Encounters came on the wake of Star Wars.
Yes.
So everybody was in science fiction fever. I was a middle schooler when Star Wars came out. And we just couldn't. What was great about Star Wars in 1977 is, if you were a science fiction fan before Star Wars, in school you were an outcast. After Star Wars came out, everybody in school was talking science fiction, and now you were the expert. So Star Wars was was very revitalizing for a lot of us nerdier kids in school who were into science fiction before that. And then Close Encounters comes out, and then you've got Battlestar Galactica comes out. And then you have a whole string of big-budget science fiction films all trying to cash in on Star Wars, like Disney's Black Hole, and a really fun one called Battle Beyond the Stars, which recycled the cast of The Magnificent Seven and set them in space. So you've got George Peppard. You've got John Boy Richard Thomas. You've got Robert Vaughn. And they are absolutely wonderful. This is a little gem, folks, and if you haven't seen it, rent it or buy a cheap copy of it, Battle Beyond the Stars. It was a Roger Corman film, his biggest budget movie ever. And darn it, he pulls it off. It's just fun science fiction. And you can't have too much fun science fiction that works, if it works.
You know, one, as you're talking and I'm thinking about how far out can you go and really be successful? And I thought The Fly was something like that. Would you say?
Yeah, you mean one with Jeff Goldblum?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Nicely redone of the original 1957 Fly. Goldblum, of course, brings a lot of heart to it. He was at his peak of his career when they made that movie. So that's a good, powerful film.
That's taking that different direction.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought? And making it so powerful. I'm so impressed.
Well, if we really want to go out there, thank you for opening that door, John. I'm going to throw out there a film that science fiction nerds love, but the general population doesn't even know exists. Buckaroo Banzai.
Oh, God. Yes.
It's a wonderful movie. Now, some people love it, some people hate it, but I have always loved it. And one of my favorite things in Spielberg's Rogue One, which drew from every franchise in existence, was when the main character shows up dressed like Buckaroo Banzai. I'm like, oh, Spielberg likes the movie too. Thank you.
Was Buckaroo a big camp?
It was very campy. It was the only time you had John Lithgow and Christopher Lloyd together in one movie, and you put those two in the cockpit of a spaceship. How can you go wrong? And it's filled with little one-liners. You laugh while you can, monkey boy. And I love that about it. It's so original. It is so fresh, and I was disappointed that they didn't do another one.
KG Klein, we're talking about Star Wars, Mandalorian, and Grogu. You are typically enthusiastic about the good parts of it, which I so much appreciate, but you're also aware of its weaknesses. I'm clueless about the whole thing, and I remember when I saw a little ad in the Boston Globe in 1977 for this Star Wars movie, and there was not the hype that we have today. So nobody had any idea what it was going to be, so I took my kids. All right? We went just because we do that kind of thing in Boston. We'll go to plays, we'll go to movies. So we went to that one. And I think they were probably speechless.
May 25th, 1977 was a day when Hollywood changed the world. Really, really changed our culture.
Yes.
And we talk about this when we're not on the show, about how Hollywood changes our culture.
Yeah.
Hollywood has the ability to change the perception of everyone, almost everyone in the world. There's places that don't have movies and TV, but everyone who has access to films has been transformed in one way or another by some movie or movies. And Star Wars would be at the top of my list when it comes to movies that really changed the world.
You are echoing what you and I have talked about so many times. The most powerful, most influential art form in the history of civilization is movies.
It is definitely movies.
And they're available around the world. They're topics to be talked on anytime you go, even internationally. They're just, as you were saying, they're just really powerful.
I think every one of us remembers the first time we saw Star Wars, or the first time we saw Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Or Rocky. Yeah.
Or 2001. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. These are movies, the first time, or even The Wizard of Oz, the first time you saw them, it had a profound effect. And I'm sure that every single one of our listeners has some other movie, a lesser movie, that affected them in a very personal way that maybe they don't talk about because it's not that popular of a movie, but it impacted them.
Yes. I'm going to close us out today with a favorite quote of mine that I frequently use when I'm presenting about movies. And I've never done it on this show, but you're inspiring me to quote Woody Allen. I miss him terribly. I miss his sense of humor.
Yeah, I'd like to see him in theaters again.
But here's what he said. If my motion picture has made one more person miserable, I feel I've done my job.
That does sound like Woody.